So, good morning and welcome to the last day of Sunstone. This is session 315, titled Colorism and the Book of Mormon. By way of announcement, the Sunstone Education Foundation is a 501c3 and depends on your generous donations. It's the last day, so I get to do the money talk. If you are in a place to do so, please consider making a contribution at the desk. You can support Sunstone by purchasing some of our conference-themed merchandise, including lanyard pins of some of Sunstone's most esteemed scholars and other prominent figures in Mormonism. Audio for this session and others throughout the conference will be available for purchase at the Sunstone AV desk, also located on the concourse. This conference has an official app. You should all get it. It's cool. Look in your printed program for instructions on how to download the WOVA app to get real-time updates for the conference, including connecting with other attendees. So this session, Colorism in the Book of Mormon, deals with how does the theme of race and color in the Book of Mormon impact communities of color? This session will explore how the discourse contributes to colorism. Ryan McKnight is the founder of Mormon Leaks and the executive director of the Truth and Transparency Foundation. You've all probably heard of him. He has a master's degree in accounting from UNLV and is a former agent with the Nevada Gaming Control Board. Sam Galvez is a queer Guatemalan immigrant, activist, and neuroscientist. As a 2014 Point Scholar, he has particular interest in healthcare, queer theologies, and baked goods. That's awesome, actually.
All right. Thank you, Christina. I'm going to pull up something here for Sammy. And he's going to start, and then I'll jump in, and then we'll go back to him, and we'll kind of do a little dance. So give me just a second, Sammy. Okay, I've got the two pictures up on the screen, Sammy.
Okay, so we're going to start with kind of a metaphor here to help us understand what we're going to talk about today, because we need to cover some basics before we delve into this a little deeper conversation. So I want you to take a look at these two pictures. These are pictures that I just found on Google. I first Googled people from the Dominican Republic, and this is what came up. And then on the right, this is a picture that I found when I Googled people from Haiti. And I had a friend who was called to serve a mission in the Dominican Republic and was talking to a member. And he was very new in the mission field. He was, you know, just fresh out, didn't really know much about the history of these countries or anything. And this member was complaining about, people from Haiti. And he was just saying how the Haitians were crossing the border and they were just causing all these bad things. And then out of, naivete or just ignorance, my friend said, well, how do you know they're Haitians? They look just like you. And this member, let me tell you, did not let the missionaries come back until Mike was out of the area again. He was so insulted that he was being Haitian. And as you can see in these two pictures, it is really hard to tell who is Haitian and who is Dominican, because in the United States, we'd just say, oh, they're both black. However, if we were to go and ask them, neither of them would say they're black. They would rather say that they are Dominican or Haitian. And so the reason why I am talking about this, and you can go back to me now, okay, is because I wanted to do a basic explanation of how race is socially constructed. And this is I think it's very easy to see in the Dominican Republic. Because in the Dominican Republic, people really do look the same to outsiders. And so people might not be able to tell the difference. But there is a real difference in the Dominican Republic and in Haiti. I had the chance of to live there last year. And it was very clear there were socially constructed differences based mostly on language. And so, different ideas in different societies build different constructs of what a race is. So here in the United, so let's hear some of the, I'm going to give you some of the time to share some of your stories now, Ryan.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to jump in real quick and we'll get back to him. And I just wanted to say that I think we're all going to be really in for a treat when Sammy really gets into the meat of what he's going to talk about today. Cause he really has an amazing insight on this. Now, you guys might all be wondering, what's the guy from Mormon Leaks doing here? because this has nothing to do with Mormon Leaks, obviously. But a lot of people don't know that I grew up in South and Central America for a lot of my youth, especially the formative years. You know, I think from about 10 years old till I went on my mission at 19, I lived in various different countries. I lived in Venezuela, Honduras. I lived in Guatemala, where Sammy's from. I actually graduated from high school there. I lived there during my junior and senior year. And I lived in Peru for a short time. My parents moved there after high school, my high school, and I was there for a little bit before I went on my mission. And I had this really unique experience that there are other Americans that do grow up in those countries, you know, based on, you know, whether their parents work for the church or for the U.S. government or an American company or whatever. But there's not a lot of us there. It's a small group. And so I don't know if you guys have ever heard of third culture kids. If not, Google it. That's kind of what I am, I suppose. It's called third culture kids. So kids who grow up in cultures that are outside of their native culture. And so I grew up in these countries, and obviously I went to church with, the local people, the regular Guatemalans or Hondurans or whatever. But we brought with us a worldview that at the time, to be perfectly honest with you, I was not as cognizant of it as I am now. But one of the things that I was talking to Sammy about on the phone in preparation for this is I was telling him about how all of the Americans in these countries, however small or large the group of Americans were that were also Mormon. For example, in Guatemala, I think there was maybe 15 to 20 of us. We would all go to the same ward in Guatemala City, and it would be a ward of local Guatemalans as well. But we all believed and openly talked about how we were all very blessed to be living and going to church among the Lamanites, or at least the descendants of the Lamanites. And for us, this was like not a controversial thing to say. It was not, it wasn't even a question for us. It was just a given. And I mean, I don't necessarily have any specific memories of having discussions like that with the local people, but I'm sure I did. I'm sure we referred to them as descendants of the Lamanites. I know when we would travel throughout the country of Guatemala, the outside of the city, and we would go to some of the more indigenous places, we would always reference how these are even more pure Lamanites than they are in Guatemala City, because they don't have as much of the Spanish influence into their, you know, genetics or whatever. And some of the languages that they speak in those countries, the indigenous languages like Quiche and Quechua and all these kinds of things, we believe they were derived from Reformed Egyptian or whatever it is the Book of Mormon people were speaking. And so we brought with us this mentality, and that mentality affected the way that we treated them. And to be perfectly honest with you, it affected the way that they treated us as well. And I'm not going to get into that right now, but I'll probably talk about that a little bit later, about how we were treated as being sort of these white American Mormons coming into church. But I just kind of wanted to talk about how we came in and we believed and projected upon them that they were Lamanites. And so that's kind of the setup that I wanted to give to what Sam is going to talk about here. So go ahead, Sammy.
Okay, so we're going to go back to the basics again of where the concept of race comes from in the United States. And it was brought over from Europe. And during the scientific, revolution that happened in the 18th, 19th centuries, people started exploring new concepts of new ideas, and particularly in genetics with Darwin and his theory of evolution. People started thinking, well, then does this apply to humans? And how does this compare? And so people came up with different classifications of humans. And basically there were four basic ones that they had in Europe, at least, that was Negroid, Mongoloid, Caucasoid, and Australoids. And they applied these different categories to people from different parts of the world. But it was really based only on physical appearances, because even though there was some knowledge regarding genetics, there wasn't really a specific knowledge as to what. They couldn't test the genetics of each person individually. So it was really done out of just, what do people look like? And, that's how we're going to classify them. And so that remained, when people came over to the United States, when people from, you know, Europe came to colonize and begin what today is the United States, they brought some of these ideas with them. And this kind of has remained unchanged, mostly in the United States, because there wasn't really a lot of mixing. I mean, there was some, but it has gone mostly, you know, it has not been spoken of. It was a taboo to marry with a different race. And so it hasn't, the story of mixed race people hasn't really been told until very recently. And you can see that in census forms. The different census forms of the United States tell us the history of how race was understood. So, for example, if you go back a few years, you can see that there are different classifications like Italian American or Polish American. And people were fighting each other over, oh, you're Italian. The Italians are bringing really terrible things to the United States. And there were many people who were Italian immigrants in the United States who were actually lynched because they were Italian and because there were negative connotations to being Italian in the United States at least 100 years ago. And so things have changed, you know, and our understanding of race in the United States has changed dramatically. And today, in the latest census, now you can say, oh, I have two races. I am a biracial or I am multiracial. However, these earlier ideas of race were very prominent when Joseph Smith was producing the Book of Mormon. And so they very much influence and inform the ideas of race in the Book of Mormon, and they can be seen as reflected in there. One of the examples in particular that are relevant are the one drop rule. For those who are not familiar with this, it's this idea that if there was a white person and there was a black person and they intermarried, if you had just one drop of like African blood in you, you were no longer considered white. And so this was very important, again, because it was this protection of whiteness. And if you can see in the Book of Mormon, with the rise of the creation of Nephite Lamanite, the one-drop rule is kind of reflected there too, because it says that if Nephites mix with Lamanites, then the curse of the Lamanites would be passed on to their children, meaning they were no longer considered Nephites. And again, this doesn't work like this in many societies. But that's kind of the history of race in the United States. Now, we're going to move on to Guatemala and how race has evolved in Guatemala, because just like race is different in the Dominican Republic, it is also different in Guatemala. So the main difference between Guatemala and the United States in the creation of the concept of race is that in Guatemala, there was a lot more mixing, and mixing was just a given. And so with Spaniards coming into Guatemala and mixing a lot with indigenous peoples, gave rise to different conceptions of race. And the one-drop rule kind of worked differently. So it was kind of, the whiter you are, the higher up the hierarchy you are, being half white was still preferable than, you know, being fully indigenous. And so if you were half white, then you were mestizo. And then there were also peninsulares who were descendants from the Spanish who were born in Guatemala, but who were still fully white. The classification wasn't really based on like the color of your skin, because, for example, you could be half indigenous, half white, and you were brown, you know, but that didn't mean that you classified as indigenous because you were Spanish, and so you were mestizo. And so there were different classifications. And this started to change because you couldn't really tell if some people were mestizo or if they were indigenous. And so you couldn't just use your skin color, and you had to use different markers in order to figure this out. And so some of them were, for example, language, accent, religion, the type of hair that people had, the eye shape. And so, you know, just very different characteristics. Now, this also meant that for people who were in the middle, who were the majority of Guatemalans, they didn't really want to, they knew that they were part indigenous, but they didn't really want to identify with indigenous culture because, again, indigenous people were seen as less. And so this gave rise to the racist culture that exists today in Guatemala. And the way that this works in Guatemala is the whiter you are, the better off you are. And this translates into daily life as, you know, even if you look as brown as I am, then you can ask your parents or grandparents and say, where did we come from? And they will tell you, oh, we came from Spain. And then I ask, well, then why are we brown? And then they're going to say, oh, you know, just centuries of tanning. And so this has in turn become kind of a denial of indigenous heritage, you know, and people just say they change their last names, they change their first names because they don't want to be seen as indigenous because there are such negative connotations that are carried into indigenous identity. And so, for example, if you told someone, even the name indigenous is used pejoratively in Guatemala. And so this is why it's important to understand this, because color was not used as the defining feature, but it was rather the other different features like language and last name and first name and so on. And this was seen everywhere, you know, from the schooling system to your family. And even today, you can still see it all over the place. So now let's bring in Mormonism. How does Mormonism, like, you know, spice things up a little bit? So Mormonism comes in with kind of a hierarchy of U.S. racial identities and tries to impose those identities into Guatemalan society. But it doesn't really translate that well. Like Ryan said, he went to a ward that was, you know, and I know from my perception of that word, I can tell you people in Guatemala know that that word is a fancy word. People who go there are mostly, you know, like U.S. Americans, or they're just people who are mostly white and people who certainly don't see themselves as Lamanites. And so it is very interesting because, you know, many Americans may come down and say, oh, we're just going to church with the Lamanites. Whereas in reality, it might be that some of these people are actually fully Spanish and they've just, you know, they've been there for generations now. But it certainly is not the most famous place. And so people come in, you know, and so Muslim comes in with these ideas of what a Lamanite is, and it starts breaking apart a little. So, for example, in Guatemalan culture, since many people who are not fully indigenous hold various views about indigenous people, then the label of Lamanite, which is attached to being indigenous, also becomes a negative label. And so, for example, people might, instead of feeling honored to be called Lamanite, they are insulted to be called Lamanite. Why? Because Lamanites are indigenous people, and indigenous people are less than us, you know? And so this racism in Guatemala informs a rejection of the label, the Lamanite. I can tell you this because I did that. And so despite, you know, knowing fully that I am half indigenous. And so, you know, it's very, so that is the first part of the rejection of the label of Lamanite. However, there are other parts that also inform the rejection of the label Lamanite. And it is the negative connotations within the Book of Mormon of who Lamanites were. And so if we read in 2 Nephi, we can see what, the negative connotations that were given as people who were lazy, who were ugly, unattractive, you know, to others, people who would just spend all day doing nothing. And this was kind of, I heard it, I heard it at my home, I heard it with different people who were saying, oh, you know, like, we are Lamanites because we are not lazy like that. But if you go see indigenous communities, they really are lazy and they really are dirty and they really are, you know, all these things. But again, these were true, first of all, because we were also half indigenous. And second of all, because these have to do more with, for example, communities that are poor. And so they don't have really a lot of resources. But also, they're just generalizations. Because, of course, that the idea that indigenous people are lazy or that they are, you know, like in one way or another, negative in any sense, it's just plainly racist. And so this is how I was going to see that the term Lamanite starts getting a little more complicated. Because it doesn't always look like this. We wanted to share a few of our experiences that we lived in there and see how, like, now having this background of what the label Lamanite means and the racial context of Guatemala and both the United States, Ryan and I wanted to just share a few of our experiences, and then we can talk about them a little bit more. So do you want to share some of the experiences you had while living in Latin America?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and just, you know, remember, I'm sort of coming at this as, you know, I was 10, like I said, between 10 and 19, I had no idea about any of this stuff Sammy's talking about. And this was a really, as I was working with him on this presentation, it was, even at 37 years old, it was really eye-opening to hear his perspective on this. Because I never heard anybody when I was living in those countries, any of the local people, express themselves this way. So they either hadn't really come to this realization, or they were maybe too afraid to sort of vocalize it. You know, I don't know. But one of the experiences that I wanted to share actually didn't happen in South America, but it is related to it. When I was on my mission, I served my mission in Spain. And there's a lot of South American immigrants in Spain, for those that didn't know. And so a lot of the people that we taught were from mostly South America, some Central America. And there was one family that we were teaching, and they were from Chile, and they were very dark brown skin. You know, I don't know what their actual genealogy was, but just from an eyeball's glance, they appeared to be more indigenous than not, right? And so they got baptized. It was a nice family, a couple and a husband and wife and a couple of kids. And we're excited as missionaries, as always are. And if those that served a mission, you probably remember that usually after you'd have a baptism, you'd take one of the members from the ward and maybe do some follow-up lessons post-baptism and try to get them to know ward members and whatnot. So we took with us the ward mission leader, who was a Spaniard, you know, completely white skin, and he was very Orthodox, especially by Spanish standards. Because in Spain, you know, the church is still relatively new there, so, you know, Spaniards' grasp of Mormonism is sometimes very sort of superficial. They don't have as much Orthodox thoughts as maybe you would in Sandy, Utah. But this guy had really sort of grabbed onto some of the things that maybe people would consider like deep doctrine. And, you know, he would read like, you know, Bruce R. McConkie and all these other like obscure church stuff that maybe other Spaniards wouldn't read. So we go to visit this family, and at some point during the evening, he says to them that, you know, it's such a awesome and great blessing that you guys have joined the church and have finally found the true church. And one of the greatest blessings that's going to come from this is that your grandchildren are going to be whiter. And the blood just drained from my companion and I. And to be honest with you, I, at the time, I don't even really think I was aware of the idea that skin would become whiter, you know, with righteousness. I don't think that I was even really fully aware of that. So when I heard this, I was just like mortified of it. You know what I mean? And my companion as well. My companion was from Spain, but we, after the lesson, I think we maybe just quickly wrapped it up. And after the lesson, you know, we had like, my companion kind of gave this guy a tongue lashing, but that couple didn't come to church for like another 2 or 3 months after. They had just been baptized, and they, you know, and they didn't know anything about racism in the Book of Mormon or anything, much less this idea that their skin would turn lighter over the generations. But yeah, and this Mormon guy there in Spain, like,
I don't really think he meant any malice. I mean, he truly believed that what he was saying was just a fact. And he was completely oblivious and naive to what it is he was actually implying. Another thing that I was going to share, and it's somewhat, it's not so much about sort of the Lamanite label of it, but one of the, and this is just anecdotal, so I don't want to suggest that this is like the rule in South and Central America. This could be very well be unique to my own experience. But when we would move, because of my dad's job, we would only move to these countries, and we would know going in that we were only going to be there for 2 years. It wasn't like we moved there and then, oh, we didn't know when we were going to move. And so we would, you know, find the local ward. We would go, and they knew in 2 years we're gone. I believe in every country that we lived in, my dad served in the bishopric. And that's really weird when you think about it. And especially when when you think about, not only, you know, think you get there, you get settled in. I mean, it's probably 4 or 5 months before they're going to call him to begin with. And then he's there for a year and a half, and they know that going in. And I look back on it, and to me, the biggest travesty of that, and well, maybe I should back up for a second. I think a lot of that is rooted in another aspect of what would happen when we would show up, is that everybody would look to us as being sort of like this fountain of perfect knowledge about the church, because we were from the motherland, you know, from the religious aspect. And I mean, that was far from the church truth. We were just regular people living in their country. But they had this perception that had been drilled into them by the church, subconsciously or overtly or subtly, you know, all these different things. And it had seeped into their thinking that, hey, you know, there's some Americans there. We need to find out what they have to say about this. And whatever they say is most likely, you know, the best course of action. And again, at the time, in the moment, not only did I not notice it as much, but even just a little bit that I noticed, it didn't really seem that weird to me. So the thing with my dad and the bishopric, it makes me think now, I look back and I think of, like, within the framework of a believing Mormon, it was taking away a lot of leadership and development opportunities from some of the local people. And, I mean, that's a travesty, you know. Now, from an ex-Mormon standpoint, I suppose, you know, I don't really care about that. But if I'm looking at it from a believing standpoint, you know, that's, you know, not really a good thing. The one other story that I'll tell, and it's maybe more amusing than anything, but it still has probably an underlying deeper message. But I had just turned 16. I think I was living in Honduras. And we were at stake conference at the stake center, which was not our building. And we were just sitting in the pews. And the missionaries happened to be sitting behind my family. And they had this investigator with them. And she was like a young teenage girl, maybe around my age. And so we're in stake conference. It's over. And the missionaries tap me on the shoulder. And they say, hey, you know, this is, you know, so-and-so, and she's getting baptized on Saturday, and she's actually going to be in your ward, she lives in your boundaries, and she wants you to baptize her. And I was like, okay. And I did end up baptizing her. But it was weird because I look back on that now, and there was nothing wrong with the scenario. There was nothing wrong necessarily with her asking me to baptize her, but I have a feeling now, looking back on it, I wonder if it was just sort of rooted in this idea that she had been somehow built to believe that it was more special to have this random white kid baptize her than, you know, maybe a friend of hers that was Mormon or one of the missionaries that was teaching her, you know. And so I look back on that, and and after talking to Sammy, I realize that a lot of their culture and then progression, that opportunities that they have, were robbed by, you know, the mentality that's brought with the church. And like I said, I, you know, a lot of times, I can tell you in my case, it was being done without us even really realizing what was going on, because we had been fed a bill of goods just like they had been, you know. So I may have a couple other stories, but I'll hand it over to Sammy here.
Okay, so now we're just going to dig into like particularities of Mormonism. So we're going to start by reading the origin of the word Lamanite in 2 Nephi chapter 5, verses starting at verse 20. And this is where we see the birth of the Lamanite. And it says, "Wherefore the word of the Lord was fulfilled, which he spake unto me, saying that, inasmuch as they will not hearken unto thy words, they shall be cut off from the presence of the Lord. And behold, they were cut off from his presence. And he had caused the cursing to come upon them, yea, even a sore cursing because of their iniquity. For behold, they had hardened their hearts against him, that they had become like unto a flint. Wherefore, as they were white and exceedingly fair and delightsome, that they might not be enticing upon the people of the upon my people, the Lord did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them. And thus saith the Lord, I will cause that they shall be loathsome unto thy people, and they shall say they shall repent of their iniquities. And cursed shall be the seed of him that mixes with their seed, for they shall be cursed even with the same cursing. And the Lord spake it, and it was done. And because of their cursing which was upon them, they did become an idle people, full of mischief and subtlety, and did seek in the wilderness for beasts of prey." Okay, so we see how positive the label of Lamanite is right out from the start. And obviously, you know, this verse has been interpreted in many different ways, and there's not one meaning to the text, and we can certainly use this text and in many different ways. However, we also must recognize that these few verses have been used as a basis for colonization, discrimination of indigenous people throughout all of the Americas from the beginning of the church. So regardless of how you feel about these verses, we must recognize the history that they carry with them. In particular, when we look back at what prophets in the past have said, it was very clear that they were using it as a way of saying that indigenous people were just idle and they were full of mischief and subtlety. And they were kind of, you know, they weren't really good unless they repented. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because what does that mean? What does it mean in this context to repent? First of all, it's really inaccurate to just assume that people are living terrible lives and that they need to repent. Why? Because we don't know them. We don't know anything about them, especially when we make such a generalization of an entire group of people, right? We see the prophecies that were made that Lamanites would blossom as the rose. But again, this is dependent on that repentance. And this repentance really, whether it was intended or not, it became a code word for evangelization and colonization. So meaning the abandonment of cultural practices that were, the cultural heritage of indigenous people, and the adoption of these new practices. And so, for example, we have the LDS Church that engaged in kind of exchange programs with Native Americans, where they would take them away from their homes and then send them out into schools and then try to reform them. And you know, there are records of many church leaders saying, "Oh, look at them. It's only been a few years and they're already looking better to me." And so again, this was dependent. This really wasn't so much, at least in practice, it ended up being a reformation of cultural activities instead of an actual call to repentance. And we also see it in, for example, the way that we allow people to dress. For example, there have been, I remember a couple of years ago, the first sister missionary who was fully indigenous was called to serve. And she was not allowed to wear her indigenous attire in her mission, and she was asked to take it off and to wear more Western clothes. Again, I'm not going to say whether this is good or bad. I think you can make your own judgment. But the truth is that this represents cultural erasure. and that these conditions of blossoming as the rose are really just, okay, you're going to blossom as much as you embrace this culture from, you know, Utah, really. And so this became really problematic because indigenous people in Guatemala were not only under the influence of U.S. racism as imposed by Mormonism, but also at the bottom of Guatemalan racism as imposed by history. And this ends up being just, you know, like very, very, very difficult because you are at the same, it's kind of like benevolent sexism where you say, oh, you're so wonderful because you're a woman, but I'm not going to let you drive because you're a woman. Similarly, it's like saying, oh, you're so wonderful because you're a Lamanite, but also you need to stop being a Lamanite in order to be able to be wonderful, like I was saying. And so this is why this label of Lamanite is very problematic in different ways. And the last thing I want to point out about the problematics behind the word Lamanite are that it really has a lot to do with aesthetics and the way things look like. The church has worked really, really hard to make like practices uniform throughout the world, regardless of culture. They want the church to look a certain way no matter where you go. And so, you know, that certainly has its benefits because then it's easier to manage. However, this has translated into this, again, erasure. And so where being like Utah is seen as the goal. And that means either be baptized by someone from Utah or going to church with people from Utah or, like me, going to BYU. You know, so we see how all these things work together and create this complicated and problematic of idea as Lamanite. Now, Lamanite can also be a good term, and we need to talk about how it can be a good label. And this, again, we need to understand that race and the way that we use the words for race change over time. So, for example, we know that and I think for many white people in the United States, it's like, oh, what do, for example, in relation to black people, they're like, what do I call them? Do I call them black or African American or I don't know what I should call them? Well, and again, it's not about what we should call them, but it's about allowing us to listen to people and listen to their stories and then allow them to self-identify and respect the history and the self-determination that comes into that self-identification. And so Lamanite can certainly be a good label. In many places of Guatemala, the word people have certainly been helped by the church in many different ways, particularly through the Perpetual Education Fund, which operates in Guatemala and allows many people who had no opportunities to access higher education. And so many, and particularly for indigenous people who tend to be on the lower end of like income in Guatemala, this has been really good. And so the church has helped them in different ways. And so people have really embraced the label of Lamanite as a great thing. And they say, well, this is empowering to me because I no longer see my indigenous identity as something bad, but rather as a divine calling to help gather Israel and to bring like the gospel into the world and to also be able to, you know, produce the Book of Mormon, you know, the most, what they perceive to be the most correct and most powerful book on the earth. And so this can certainly be a very powerful movement. Also, in recent years, many indigenous movements in Guatemala had started looking back at their identity as the Maya, and this has been very empowering as well because they see themselves as like these great empires. And instead of seeing indigenous identity as like, oh, you know, like we're the lowest of the low, they're saying, no, we're this great empire, this great culture that lived and had math and astronomy and science and agriculture, and that was destroyed pretty much. And we're going to reclaim that. And in the context of Mormonism, that is done through using the label Lamanite and saying we are these Lamanites and we were destroyed. We've been afflicted through colonization and through all these different things. But now we're going to reclaim it and we're going to show the world the good that is in us. And so it is very important to recognize that even though the label Lamanite carries heavy, like, problematic themes, it can also be used as a label for self-empowerment, and it can be reclaimed to be used as, like, an honoring label. However, this is very much exclusive to Mormonism. So again, if you're wondering, well, what do I do now with the word Lamanite? Who is a Lamanite? Who is not a Lamanite? Who do I get to call a Lamanite? Really, again, we should be very cognizant of who is reclaiming this label and who is able to, like, use it and grab the positive in it, and who decides to reject it and say, no, this, because of the negative history behind it, I'm going to reject it. So do Lamanites exist today? Well, there are certainly people who identify as Lamanite. And regardless of the history of the Book of Mormon and the accuracy of it all, we must recognize that these labels carry cultural and historic significance. And so for some people who have been in the church now for three generations or more, the label Lamanite already carries a history. And so Lamanites today certainly exist, but we must allow them to determine who they are instead of trying to impose our ideas of who we think is Lamanite and who we think is not Lamanite to be imposed into different communities.
Yeah. Let me jump in there real quick, Sammy, because you were making me think of something. You know, when it comes to, you were talking there a little bit about the cultural erasure there that occurs with this dynamic. I remember when, you know, one of the things that I loved about living in especially in Central America was the immediate access that I had to all of the Mayan history, and I was obsessed with it when I was a teenager. And it was, my obsession was completely based on the fact that I thought that when we would go and visit these Mayan ruins, which my family did frequently, we were all assuming that we were walking the lands that the Nephites and the Lamanites walked. And I remember in the ward that we attended in Guatemala, which was sort of right, it was actually part of, like, the temple square there, there was a lot of the Book of Mormon tours that you all hear about. They would often, especially if their trip ended like on a Sunday and maybe their plane was leaving that night, they would come to Sacrament at that ward. And so I ended up getting to meet a lot of these tour guides. There was one guy who was really famous back in the 90s, famous in the world of Book of Mormon tours. His name was James Allen, I believe was his name. And I think he was part of Farms back then. I could be wrong on that. But he had written some books on the subject, and he took people down there. And I had his book, and he signed it for me and everything. And one of the things that I have a lot of regret about is that I don't actually know much about the actual Mayan history, because every time, and I have been to some of the most amazing places in the world when it comes to ancient history, and I didn't take it in its real fashion, because I approached everything to, you know, how this applies to the Book of Mormon. And I remember one particular thing. This was in Honduras, in a place called Copan. I don't know if anybody's been down there and have heard of it. This is one of the major Mayan cities back in, I don't recall what the time frame is, but, you know, we're talking about, 1,500 years ago. And we had this tour guide. We were there with another Mormon family, American Mormon family, and we'd made this trip together. And I know that the tour guide was not a Mormon, but he knew that we were Mormons. And I'm guessing he had dealt with Mormons before. Okay, I'm setting this up for something, right? So we're walking around this city of Copan, and we come across this big rectangular dugout, almost like bathtub type thing that was filled in with whatever their cement was. I don't know if it's actually cement, but you get it. And he says to us, this, we don't actually really know what it is. We think it was a place where some, outsiders or, rejects of the society back then would practice their religious ceremonies. And we're all looked at each other and we're like, yeah, these were the few sort of, maybe the few Nephites that somehow survived, and they were, this is where they got baptized. This was the baptismal font. I walked away from there thinking that was a Nephite baptismal font. And so I was talking to my wife last year. I was telling her, we need to you know, systematically go and I need to revisit all of these places because I missed out on this like unbelievable opportunity, and that's something that I really regret. I'll turn it back over to Sammy to wrap this up. Sammy, we've probably got maybe 5 or 6 minutes, and then we can turn it over to see if there's any questions.
Yeah. So what do we do? What do we do with this? What do we do as people who are in the world of Mormonism? Whether you identify as a faithful Mormon, an ex-Mormon, what do we do? I think it is important, first of all, to recognize and listen to indigenous voices. There are indigenous voices who are working all over, indigenous people who are working all over from Canada to Chile and Argentina, and they are telling us, they are talking to us. So we, not from the grave, not from the dust, they're talking to us through Facebook, they're talking to us in our legislatures. So let's listen to them, because there are many important things that are affecting indigenous communities all over this continent, and we need to listen to them, because indigenous people continue to be at the end of racist and almost and genocidal influences that have tried to kill their culture, kill their history, and kill their people over centuries. So we need to stop just imagining what the Lamanites would say nowadays and actually listen to what people who are indigenous to this land have to say. Second of all, I think even if we are faithful Mormons, and even if we do believe that the Book of Mormon happened, and the history in the Book of Mormon is an accurate depiction of the history of the American continent, it is important to not let that narrative erase other narratives. For example, the narrative of the Maya and what happened, like Ryan was saying, you know, just because you believe that this one thing happened doesn't mean that you shouldn't learn about other things that happened. And so I think we can create space for that duality. In learning about, you know, all the different languages that were spoken in this continent, which were hundreds and thousands and are still spoken today. And we can just, like, create that space. And I think the last thing that I think we need to do is to just allow indigenous people to, determine their own destiny. And again, that begins by listening to indigenous activists, and so on. And I think if you're confused as to why I refer to indigenous, like I don't speak of myself as indigenous, it is because back in Guatemala, I was given the privileges of like not being indigenous despite of how I look because of the language that I spoke. And so I think it's very important for me to recognize that privilege that I cannot, you know, speak in behalf of them. And that's why my hope it is that through this presentation, I can help us all to listen to them. And there are many artists. You can certainly learn about people in Guatemala, but there are people in Utah who are doing this work, like Moroni. I don't know if people here know who Moroni is, but he's a great indigenous activist in Utah. And so,
He's here, by the way, so you might see him walking around. Oh. I know he's here, so.
Yeah. So kind of a lift where you stand kind of a thing, you know, certainly Utah is indigenous land, and we need to listen to people who are there. So that is my hope, that these are the things that we can do as we go, as we move forward from this presentation. And I think we can turn it now to questions.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Sammy. Yeah. So we have about 10 minutes left in our session. So if anybody has any questions, if you can come up to the mic and ask it, because if you speak into the mic, Sammy will be able to hear the question.
So the church has largely kind of backed away from identifying indigenous people with Lamanites recently. I'm wondering what you feel is the church's ethical responsibility when it comes to a very long history of erasing, replacing the native cultures of indigenous people with this Lamanite narrative.
Were you able to hear that, Sammy?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think first of all, is they must engage with indigenous leaders and listen to them. There are many members of the church who are indigenous, who have been in the church for generations, and it's about time that they are listened to. I also think that it's important for the church to be fully transparent in all languages. So, for example, there are... and the particular example I'm thinking of is, for example, the church essays and church materials. Sometimes it takes the church a little bit of time to translate materials into Spanish or other languages. One of the ways in which the church controls the flow of information from Salt Lake City or from the United States into the rest of the world is simply by not translating it. Many members in Guatemala, for example, are still using very outdated manuals with outdated ideas influenced by, like, for example, Bruce R. McConkie or Spencer W. Kimball, who kind of more embraced more racist ideas about, you know, the label Lamanite. Even if in Utah or in the United States we are moving past that, in Guatemala, that's not happening because the materials aren't being updated and because we're not being clear about this. So I think the church does have a responsibility to be consistent and to make sure that its materials are available in all languages. And, you know, if they can translate Meet the Mormons into 10 languages in a month, they certainly can translate their manuals into many languages over, like, you know, at least a year. So I think the church should definitely make these materials available to everyone in their languages.
All right, we got another question here.
Hi, I'm Abe Collier. Sammy, you and I were in an award down at BYU many, many years ago. I'm just wondering, Ryan or Sammy, have you guys seen any examples of indigenous or partly indigenous Latter-day Saints adopting the Lamanite narrative not as a path to becoming Nephite again or a path to becoming westernized or whatever, but adopting the Lamanite narrative as a path to reclaim their indigenous heritage?
I'll give my answer and then Sammy can. I don't know that I have a lot of experience seeing that personally, but I do. I have a friend who is 100% Navajo, and he has told me that his mother, who is obviously also 100% Navajo and grew up on the reservation and speaks the language, she fully believes that she is a Lamanite and embraces the label fully. So I don't know, you know, that's an example there.
I have a friend, his name is Juan Reanda, and he was born and raised in Santiago Atitlán, Guatemala. And he actually served a mission in Salt Lake City, so he speaks English. But he very much embraces the label Lamanite, and he uses it, and he has reclaimed it, and is very proud of that label. And, you know, he was the Lamanite that went to preach to Zion. So,
okay, we got another question.
So I grew up in Mesa, Arizona. I still live there. My temple was known as the Lamanite Temple. And very often I would go and just walk around the back part of the visitor center that is now being demolished and turning into a much larger building. But it was covered in copies of the Book of Mormon in every conceivable language that the church would publish, full transcriptions or parts. I serve my mission in Argentina. I have a degree in Spanish and studied linguistics and whatnot. And this has already been touched on a little bit about how the church can publish, materials very, very quickly and the ones that they want to. I have mostly just a comment that for those of y'all still in the church, I hate to say still, for those of y'all who are engaging with the church. One way that you can really inspire those around to continue to have a voice and have their culture, protected from erasure by the church is to inspire them to speak their native languages. In many areas in the church, you are not allowed to speak a secondary language in your church building. In New Zealand, you're not allowed to speak Māori anymore. In many areas, you will get talked to if you speak Navajo. And little by little, all of those copies of the Book of Mormon that they pushed to translate in the 1900s are all going to be, you know, a couple dozen that the church is just going to focus on. And if you don't meet it, you don't fit. So for those of you who are engaging with Mormonism, you know, maybe celebrate those who you come in contact with, have events where they talk about their languages, maybe get a bunch of former missionaries together to talk about Thai or whatever language they learned on their mission. I've had a couple events in the past couple of years before I left Mormonism, and that was a really good way to kind of give voice to those who might not speak English or any of the other, you know, church-okayed languages at all. So that's just mostly mine.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, on one of the points that both you and Sammy had brought up about, you know, the translation and the dissemination of information, there's a second issue there. There's the issue of, you know, translating in multiple languages in a timely fashion, and then there's the issue of also informing the people that speak those languages that those materials exist. And one of the things that I've seen with the gospel topic essays, even though there are a number of languages that they've now been translated into, a lot of people in those countries don't even know those things exist. And, you know, here, for example, especially some of the more controversial essays, there were newspaper articles. In some cases, there were even New York Times articles. So it was even getting national attention. There's Facebook discussions in English about these things. There's, you know, Elder Ballard going to a regional conference in Arizona and saying, you know, read the essays in English. You know, he's saying that in English. But a lot of times that doesn't happen in other countries. So even though the material exists, it exists in this obscure corner of the internet, and they don't even know it's there to look at. And I have, you know, my wife is from Spain, and so I have a lot of family in, you know, from her side, and they're all Mormon, and they didn't know about the essays for years. You know, and they still barely, like, you know, now they kind of don't want to read them or anything. But I remember well after they had been published in Spanish, asking them if they had read them, and they didn't even, not only had they not, but they didn't even know what I was talking about. And they, one of them works for the church in Spain. Actually, that's his actual job. So I think that we've run our course here. I really want everybody to give a round of applause for Sammy, because he brought some insight here that I know I've never been exposed to, and I'm guessing that's probably for many here. So let's give Sammy a round of applause for joining us. And Sammy, are you able to be sort of reached on social media anywhere? Do you want to put a plug out there of where people can maybe reach you?
I recently changed my social media to, like, very private.
Oh, okay.
So, like, no.
I didn't know. All right. Sorry, guys.
I guess if you have questions for me, you can write me an email. My email is galvezsj@gmail.com.
Galvez.
But yeah,
SJ.
Galvez is big. Yeah, I recently decided that my social media is just for me and my friends.
Probably for the best. We probably all should do that. All right, Sammy, thank you so much, and I'll talk to you a little bit later.
Thank you, Ryan.
Okay, bye.
Thank you, everyone.